In the past lectures, we have seen how we have related order to symmetry breaking, and quantum phase transitions to a diverging correlation length. But we have seen that by understanding better what is the meaning of a dramatic change in a quantum state, all we can say is that a finite gap means everything will be smooth, but not the other way around. In fact, we have just claimed that the finite gap means that everything will be smooth, because we borrowed this result that a finite gap implies a finite correlation length, which is definitely true in the systems that we have solved, like the quantumizing model, but we want to prove it in general. To this end, we need to acquire a technical tool called Lieb-Robinson bounds. And this is a beautiful result that was found by Lieb-Robinson in 1972. Then it was forgotten and dug up again in 2006 by Matthew Hastings, and with which we can prove a lot of stuff that is very interesting in condensed matter theory. But apart from its interest as a technical tool and its importance in condensed matter theory, the Lieb-Robinson bounds have an enormous and deep significance in quantum theory in general. Okay, so let's start with setting the stage for our Lieb-Robinson bounds. And first of all, let us understand a bit better what is locality in quantum physics. So if you remember, we have defined what is a local quantum system. Like a local quantum system means we have some Hamiltonian that is defined by taking the tensor product of all local degrees of freedom on some graph lambda. And then we have a Hamiltonian. So this is the Hilbert space. And then we have a Hamiltonian that is the sum of some Hermitian operators that have a support on finite patches in the Hilbert space. So remember, phi of x is an operator on the Hilbert space h of x, which is just the tensor product of all the local degrees of freedom in a subset x of the local ones. And we wanted x to be limited in some way. So the number of degrees of freedom in x should be upper bounded by some number, let me call it sigma. And the diameter of x should be upper bounded by some other number that I can call r. Okay. So this is how we defined a local quantum system. This is a name, OK? So, but it means that interactions are local. Now, if interactions are local, does it mean that everything in the theory is local? Not necessarily. These are two different concepts. And in fact, look at this situation. Imagine that we have some quantum system like one of the spin chains that we have studied. So let's say that we have the Hamiltonian is the XY Hamiltonian. Okay? Consider the spin labeled by I and the spin labeled by J with I minus J large. So they are very far apart. Okay? And let's say that we prepare the system in an equilibrium state. For example, it could be the system could be prepared in the ground state of the XY mode. So this is an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian, so it will not evolve in time, right? So now imagine that I measure some observable on this spin, any observable. It could be sigma z or any other combination of the polymatrices. And I look at the expectation value of this guy at different times. And of course, I don't find anything interesting. It has a constant value. The system is not evolving. The state is always the same. So it stays put. OK. Then let's say that at t equal to zero, suddenly I change my Hamiltonian. I do something on this spin. I insert some operator vi in the Hamiltonian. So my at t equal to zero, my Hamiltonian goes to hxy plus vi. So this is another term in the Hamiltonian. So now, generically, this is not an eigenstate for the new Hamiltonian anymore. So the state of my system will start evolving. And psi of t will be equal to e to the minus I hxy plus vi t times my initial state. So, as a consequence, all the observables that I will measure in this state will be time dependent. Right? We have a time dependent state, expectation values will be time dependent. So at some time, at some point, when I measure something here, these expectation values will start changing, right? Because I gave a kick here, then everything is, you know, then this interaction will propagate through the chain. And at some time, 3t prime greater than t0, I will feel something here, right? This is what we expect. And my question is, what is the time t prime such that we finally feel at j what we have done at I? Can you give me an answer?
J times I minus J, the energy scale.
Okay, so you are using some energy scale over using it as a speed, something like that, right?
It has the right units. So,
you want to use, you say, look, here there are only two, you're thinking very right. You're thinking, here we have only two physical quantities. One is this distance, and the other one is the energy scale, right? So somehow, this time must be related by the distance over this energy scale or something like that, right? It sounds reasonable. And we would really like that to be the case. However, it is not the case. For every t greater than t0, no matter how t minus t0 is small, This operator has support everywhere. VI has support only here and cannot do anything here. But as soon as you exponentiate this, the support is everywhere for every t greater than 0 in this case. Here I should have written t minus t 0. For every t minus t 0 greater than 0. So immediately after, OJ feels what happens at I. Not really good, right? Not really good. So quantum mechanics is non-local. And so when you guys hear about the fact that quantum mechanics is non-local, people are referring to this or to something else?
Entanglement.
For instance, they're referring to entanglement. However, with entanglement, can we send superluminal signals or not? No. So here we are sending superluminal signals, right? Because no matter how much this is large, for every t we can send a signal. So the non-locality of quantum mechanics as it appears in entanglement or in other contextuality issues in quantum mechanics, or has everyone heard about the Aronoff-Bohm effect? Well, that is also a non-local effect that we will encounter in the study of topological phases, although in disguise. But again, even the Aronoff-Bohm effect cannot be used to send the superluminal signals. So that's a very, the non-locality of quantum mechanics is a very subtle and elusive non-locality that should not be translated in the so-called spooky action at the distance, because there is no way that we can send a signal in that way. But this is exactly that. We are sending a signal at arbitrarily large distance at an arbitrarily short time. So is this a paradox or what? Where's the catch? Are you very surprised by this result? Or you should not be surprised?
If you're in a physical system, it would take time for all of the spins to flip.
Yes, you know, you expect that in a real physical system, there should be some time that, as your colleague said, should be related to the energy scale of the interactions and this distance in order for a signal, you know, I do something here and I feel it here. There should be some time. So this should not happen, right? But it does happen. So are we surprised that this is happening in quantum mechanics or not? No, you should not be surprised. You should not be surprised because we know this is non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Non-relativistic quantum mechanics is wrong. It's not the real theory. We need to make it relativistic. When we make it relativistic, there is a light cone, right? And outside, so it becomes quantum field theory. Outside the light cone, you cannot send the signals. And you fix everything. In fact, it's exactly because of this reason that people, starting with Dirac and others, developed non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So you should not be surprised at all. So let me tell you when you must be surprised. You should not be surprised. This is non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Okay, what is the surprising fact? The surprising fact is that in a system like this, even though I have not imposed the relativistic structure, so there is no notion of a light cone, of a ultimate speed of signals being the speed of light, So I didn't put the structure, but the structure is already there, is hidden, and it will emerge. So what is surprising is that by the end of today, we will find that in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, there is an emergent light cone for the speed of interactions. So that eventually, in spite of the fact that this thing has a support that is everywhere on the chain, in practice, omega j, OJ will not see this signal before a certain time. Oh, now, this is surprising, right? Because I've just proven you that it would feel it. Okay, so let's see how this happens. So it is emergent. So the word emergent is a bit like black magic. You can say all you want, and you say, oh, it's emergent. So what do I mean by emergent? What I mean is that the light cone that we will find, which we didn't put by hand, it's fuzzy. What it means is fuzzy is that I can actually send a signal out of the light cone, but outside of the light cone is evanescent. It's very small. And you can say, okay, then you're cheating. Actually, I'm not cheating, because in electromagnetism, that is the relativistic invariant theory, there are evanescent waves outside the light cone in a material. Right? They cannot be used to send signals, though. So something can get outside of the light cone, but if it's very small and cannot be used to send signals, it's not really there. And this happens in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So this opens the way to say, okay, but maybe Lorentz invariance is not fundamental, it's emergent. Okay, so let's see how it happens. Okay, so our setup is the following. We have a local quantum system with these characteristics, but now we ask something more. We need to have an energy scale. So what you said is extremely important. So we want these objects that are, you know, our terms in the Hamiltonian. So remember, phi x is a term like, for instance, in the Ising model, something like J sigma z I sigma z I plus 1, right? Phi x are terms like this. And J is the energy scale. J is also the norm of this operator. 2J is the norm of this operator. So we require all the operators in our theory to have a finite energy. So we bound them all with some constant h, one constant to bound them all. OK, with these requests, very fun. With these requests, now let's study a system, lambda. Okay? Lambda is our graph. All our degrees of freedom are specially in this graph. And let us consider one region A and one region B that are far apart at some graph distance dAB. Okay. And now I will consider, and forgive me for the abuse of notation, an operator A and an operator B, and I call them A and B just because they have support on A and support on B. Okay. Of course, one thing is the region, one thing is the operator that has support there, but you understand that. So because we are in this tensor product system, and by our definition of support, you remember that Since A and B have different support, then A and B must commute. Our definition of support on a tensor product implies that these are a fancy way of calling these operators bosonic operators. They commute when they do not overlap. Just like the sigma matrices, they commute when they do not overlap. Very good. However, what happens if now I prepare my system in a state away from equilibrium? So there is a non-trivial evolution of the system. Well, we know that in the Heisenberg picture that we defined in the first lecture, A will start evolving, so it will be an operator dependent on time, and it will be e to the iht, a e to the minus iht. And exactly for the same reasons that we discussed here, generically, unless A commutes with the Hamiltonian, but for a generic operator A, the support of A of t is the full Hilbert space, right? And therefore, if I now consider the commutator between AT and B, this will be different from zero. So I have just rephrased in terms of operators more or less what I was saying here in this example. This more or less means that we will show tomorrow that all we mean by sending signals from A to B, or creating correlations that were not there from A to B, so all we mean by causality is in this statement. So tomorrow we show it, but for the time being, accept it. Okay? The fact that this is different from zero means that there is a causal effect from A to B. And unfortunately, for every t, this is different from zero. Right? So this is our problem. So what do we do? So what we would like to do is saying there is a speed that only emerges from the data of my problem, so it only depends on these numbers, such that, so because I have a speed, I can define a light cone, right? Because a light cone is defined by Vt minus d. And what I would like to show is that if we are outside of the light cone, so when Vt is smaller than d, then this thing is small. And what do I mean by small? I take the norm, the operator norm. So this is small outside of this light cone. So this means it should, how small it is? Very small. So we want to say that this is e to the vt minus d with some constant here. So you see that when d is greater than vt, or when I'm outside of the light cone, this signal is decaying exponentially, which is in fact what we mean by evanescent wave. So this is what we would like to show. that only because we have a local quantum system, there is a V that I will call V of Liebe-Robinson that only depends on sigma, R, and H. And that's it. Okay. This seems like a very difficult task, but let's see. Okay. So let me call this object, the commutator between A of t and B, let me call it F of t, just because I don't want to write too many commutators. And let me write the derivative, time derivative of F. So the time derivative of F is, of course, this thing. Do you agree with this statement? Okay. So if you just remember how the commutator is, B is a constant, does not depend on time, so we get this. And now remember our Heisenberg representation. Differentiating an operator in time is the Heisenberg equation, right? Is I commutator with H. So I can write I commutator with H B. And now there is another trick. What do you think this is? The commutator between H and U. U, let me write it here, is the time evolution operator e to the minus I h t. Let me pull this up for everyone. Okay, so what is the what is this commutator?
Zero.
Right? A time-independent Hamiltonian commutes with its exponentiation, or in general, with any function of itself. So being this zero, this means that instead of h, I can write u dagger hu. Right? It's the same thing. It means h is equal u dagger hu. Well, but this is a dagger AU, right? Sorry, U dagger AU. Well, then I can write this thing as I, U dagger, commutator between H and A, U, commutator with B. Okay. And now let's remember what is H. So I have I. H is the sum over the phi x. Commutator is linear, so the sum goes out. So here I have the x over lambda. And now we have u dagger commutator phi x A, U, commutator B. Okay, now this is interesting, because now we are not commuting with the Hamiltonian, but we are commuting with these operators that have support on X. So what happens? And X is a subset of supports all over our Hilbert space. So we have the x's that are here, the x's that are here, the x's that are here, and the x's that are here. Right? These are all supports for my interactions. And what happens when I commute A with an operator that supports here?
Zero.
Well, so in that sum, the only operators that count are those like this. So if I define, let me define it here, Z1 as the set of X such that X and A have a non-null overlap, then I can just replace this sum with the sum in Z1. Do you agree? Very well. So now what I can do is to pull back this U's inside the commutator. So I have I, the sum over X1, commutator of phi x of t, phi x1, sorry, of t, a of t, commutator b. Do you agree? Now, I want to use the Jacobi identity. Jacobi identity says that well, there are many ways of writing the Jacobi identity, but it says that A, B, C, plus B, C, A, plus C, A, B is equal to 0. Right? The sum of the cyclic commutators is 0. So let's do that. So we have I, sum over all the x1s, and then I let me see, phi x1 commutator B A of T plus A of T commutator phi x1 of T B replaces this. Is there a, there could be a sign error? Let me see. But that, so forgive me signs because they will not matter. But let me check. Let me check if I, yeah, so yes, there is a sign error. But it's an overall sign. Okay. Very good. Okay, so let me pull this up. Now notice that, oh, why did you do that? What is this object? This is our function f. So this equation has, in fact, this form, f prime is equal L0 f plus g of t, where L0 is a linear operator. So you know what, you see what I'm saying on f? I am just commuting with f, which is a linear operation, and then summing over all these commutations. So this operation is linear. It's a linear operator that doesn't act on vectors, acts on operators. It's a linear super operator, if you want. And then we have a function that is an operator, it's a function of time g of t. Well, so because this is a linear differential equation, you know how to solve it. You find a solution for the homogeneous equation, and then you add an integral of the inhomogeneous solution. And let me call gamma t, the solution for the homogeneous equation. So gamma t is the map that takes f0 and through gamma associates f of t being gamma t of f of 0 for the homogeneous equation, the one when g is equal to 0. So you see that the solution for the inhomogeneous equation will be equal to gamma t f0 plus the particular integral, that is the integral of between 0 and t. We integrate g in this variable. Let me call it s1. I could call it s, but I want to call it s1. So this is the general solution for a linear differential equation. Now, the important part, the very important part, is the nature of this gamma. We don't know what this gamma is. We just know that it exists. Solving what is gamma means solving this linear differential linear equation that we might be very complicated. But what is the homogeneous equation? Is the commutator, is f prime equal the commutator of something, f, with the sum of f of phi x1? The sum of phi x1 is a Hamiltonian, right? Because even if it's not our complete Hamiltonian, is the sum of Hermitian operators. So the solution must be unitary. In other words, so gamma t is unitary, and therefore it preserves the norm. The norm of the solution f of t is equal, by definition, by the norm of gamma t of f0, and the unitary operator preserves the norm. So this is something that we will use a lot. So if I now write f of t, the solution of the inhomogeneous equation, and I want to compute its norm, I take the norm, well, then I will have to, this will be equal to the norm of this object, right? But the norm of this object is just the norm of what is after gamma t, because gamma t is norm preserving. So this will be equal to the norm of this sum. The norm of the sum is smaller than the sum of the norms, right? So I can upper bound with f of 0 plus the norm of this object. And you know that when the norm goes through the integral, I still get an upper bound, because the integral is like a sum. So I continue upper bounding by writing the integral between 0 and t of the norm of what is inside here. And now we have gamma minus 1, which is still norm preserving. So this is the norm of g. The norm of g. And what is g? It's this object. is the part that didn't contain F. So this is the sum of the commutator between A of t and the commutator phi x1 of t b commutator. And I can put the norm inside the sum and get again an upper bound. Okay? So we have found an upper bound to our f of t. Is this bound clear? Tell me if it's not clear now, because it's getting much worse. Okay. So a useful bound for commutators is this. In general, this is always upper bounded by, as it is trivial to show, right? Using the triangular inequality. We can apply it here in the first commutator and obtain to the norm of A the norm of this. But the norm of A of t is the norm of A, right? Because what is A of t? Is a unit is that. And that's a unitary operator, so again, it's norm preserved. So going from the norm of A of t to the norm of A changes nothing. And then I have the norm of phi, commutator phi x1 of t with b. Very good. Now let me call this guy f1 of t. And I want to bound now the norm of this object. And to bound it, we do use the same technique. Okay? So I want to bound F1. So first I want to find an interesting differential equation. So let me take the derivative of F1. Okay? So what I will do is to commute phi x1, let me get some space here, with the Hamiltonian, and then commute it with b. Do you agree? But what is the Hamiltonian? And they have I. The sum over all the x's of phi x. And now you see that if x does not commute, sorry, if x has no overlap with x1, they have to commute. So if I pull down this again, remember that these green ones are x1. And now I'm looking for the axes that do not commute with x1. So they must be these ones. So you see, the interactions need to propagate through the commutator. If there is no overlap, they cannot propagate. So an x that lives here will always commute with x1. So again, this means that now I can restrict my sum I can restrict my sum to Z2 that I can define here are the x such that x2 the x2 such that x2 intersect with x1 is different from the null set when x1 is in Z1. So I'm doing exactly the same passage as before. So now this sum is on x2 in Z2. And now I can apply the Jacobi identity again. If I apply the Jacobi identity again, I will find minus I, the sum over x2 of two terms. The first one is phi x2. And let's remember what are the variables here. So when I integrated this between 0 and t, I was using the variable s1. So here I should write s1. And the integral is in ds1. So all these objects are functions of the time s1. S1 times the commutator phi x1 s1 b. So this is the first term of the Jacobi identity when I start cycling these guys, plus phi x1 of s1 commutator b 5 x2 of s1. Close. And now I want to use this one. Okay. Now you recognize that this object here is F1. So again, this differential equation is F prime 1 equal a linear operator of F1 plus another operator. So I can integrate it. I can solve this equation exactly in the same way. And then bound. And when I bound F1, so F1 at the time S1 is upper bounded by F1 at the time 0 plus the integral from 0 to S1 now in the new variable of integration that will be ds2 of 2 whatever I was trying to commute with phi, which was this term, phi x1. So this plays the role of s2 times this sum over the f, the x2. Okay. So I've used exactly the same passages that I used for here. So this means that this upper bound to F1 of S1 can be inserted in here. Right? And continue upper bounding. And we would get that f of t, so collecting these terms, is smaller than norm of f of 0 plus the integral between 0 and t in a ds1. Then we have 2a And then we have the sum over x1. Yes. And then we have this guy. F1 of 0 plus another integral between 0 and S1, dS2, 2, phi x1, and doesn't matter the time here, because we know that the time dependence goes away in this thing. Sum x2, this last commutator, b phi x2 s2. Time dependence only matters inside the commutators, but not when you have just an operator evolved in time. OK, so we have collected this term. OK, so notice that this object here, what was our definition? Was phi x1 commutator b. This is only different from 0 when x1 has an overlap with b. So you see, we are asking for x1s that have a non-null overlap with a and have a non-null overlap with b. Otherwise, this one is 0. So x1 not only needs to have a non-null overlap with a, also needs to have a non-null overlap with b, or this term is 0. What is this term? It's commutator between a and b. So this term is different from 0 only if a and b have an overlap. So at the zero order, we have a contribution only if a and b are already connected. At the order 1, we have a contribution only if a and b are connected by an x1. Right? We need a to have a non-null overlap with x1, and x1 needs to have a non-null overlap with b. So they are connected. Very good. And then this guy, when I try to bound this, will give us the second order. And we do exactly the same thing. And now you will see we will have to sum over x3 such that there is non-null overlap. But x2 will have to be such that a, x1, x2, b. It's just iterating the same procedure over and over again. So in the end, we are summing over paths that have this nature. The first element of the path has non-null intersection with A. Those labeled by I have non-null intersection with the next one. And the last one, for every order, has non-null overlap with B. If you remember our graph theory, this is a path from A to B in our hypergraph. The graph theory we needed. OK. So I can bound this again using the same procedure and then put everything in the total one. So what happens when I put everything together? I have that f of t is smaller than the sum over all the paths from A to B. And these paths can have, at the zero order, have a length 0, right? A and B already overlap. At the first order, they have a length 1, is the one in which x1 is in between, and so on and so forth. Of these objects, A there is always A. Then in the last commutator, there is always B. Then there is 2. And you see, we get a 2 from AB here. Then we get another 2 for every following interaction. For any following iteration. So for a path with n steps, starting from 0, where 0 is the 0 order, we get 2 to the n. And then we get the integral between 0 and t, then the integral between 0 and s1, and the integral 0 and sn minus 1. So for every path of n steps, we have n integrals. And we are summing over all the paths with n steps and on every n, because we are summing over all the possible paths. And now we have the commutators here between the phi. So in the end, all we have here is the product of the norms of all the phi's, right? This is phi x1, phi xn minus 1. Phi xn, because there is one since the beginning. Well, and I can upper bound this. Look at that last request about the scale of interactions by h to the n. So I can take h to the n here. Okay, now you see that these integrals are integrating nothing, are integrating the identity, right? Because this does not depend on time anymore. But still, it's complicated to understand all this. So what is this nested integrals? So I first integrate in Sn minus 1, then the result in Sn minus 2, Sn minus 2, and so on and so forth. You have done it in quantum mechanics. What is this thing called? No, please.
Just a question before. Why are you bounding again the operators by H?
Why? I requested it.
Why?
Because so I can do the proof. It's an hypothesis of a theorem. So I am, because if this product of, if any of these things is infinite in that product, well, I find a very boring bound that whatever I have is upper bound by infinity, which is not very useful. So we are requiring a finite energy for every interaction. Okay? But I will come back to your question later, at the end of the proof. We can discuss, can we relax that assumption? So in this proof, we can't, right? We are upper bounding everything with the product of these norms. If any of them is infinite, then everything collapses. Okay. Have you done in quantum field theory the Dyson series?
It's time order.
It's a time order. It's a Dyson series. So you know this is 1 of n factorial, and they integrate between 0 and t always n times. So the integral between 0 and t of nothing is t, right? So this is t to the n over n factorial. So all this is t to the n, let me also write h to the n over n factorial. And we are summing over all the possible n's. Yeah, but let's see. This sum the sum over all the parts, I could break it down in this way. I break it down, the sum over all the parts with the length n and then I sum over all the ends. Now you see that all these objects do not depend on the path anymore. So this sum over all the paths from A to B with the length n is just the number of paths from A to B of length n. Do you agree? Okay, so let me call this number sigma of n. And this is sigma n goes from 0 to infinity. Very good. Okay, what is this? Let me say it again. Number of paths of length n from A to B. So as you can see, we have an exponential that is trying to form, right? Because we have powers of n over n factorial. The only disturbing piece is this function, sigma of n, because that one is not a power of n. So we would like to keep upper bounding and trying to find an upper bound for this, that is a power of n. Okay. So we have two cases. Let's see how we can make a bound. In the first case, d, the distance between a and b, dAb, is greater than this number, n times r. So let's try to understand what is this number. So n is the length of the path, right? How many? 1, 2, 3, right? And r is the range, the maximum distance that there is between something inside any of these bubbles. So you see that in n steps, we can at maximum connect two objects that are n times r apart. So when dAb is greater than nr, then the number of paths of length n that connect a and b must be 0. So this means that whatever number greater than 0 I put here in this case, it will be an upper bound. Because in that case, it's actually 0. You agree? When d and b is smaller than n to the r, well, then there are many paths. Right? There are many paths. And let's try to upper bound this number. So a good upper bound is this. Sigma to the n. Why? Because sigma is the number of points that there is at maximum in each of these bubbles. So in n steps, I can at most make sigma to the n. There are at most sigma to the n ways of making patches that intersect. This is a very very loose upper bound. Why? Why it's a very loose upper bound? This number, in fact, is much smaller than this. So it's okay because it's an upper bound. But why it's loose? Because this is the total number of paths of length n, and this is the total number of paths of length n from A to B. So this is the number of all the paths of length n, also those that go nowhere. So this is definitely right. Okay, as a bound. And I can bound it even more, although it's loose, by multiplying by any number greater than 1. Do you agree? So let me use this number that is definitely greater than 1, that is e to the alpha nr minus dab. For every, where alpha is any number greater than 1. For any number greater than 1, this is a number greater than 1, when nr is greater than dab, which is this case. Okay. So this is an upper bound for this case. But this number is greater than 0, right? Always. Always. So it is also an upper bound for this case. So this is our total upper bound. So this means that my f of t is in the end upper bounded by the sum over all the n's from 0 to infinity of sigma to the n e to the alpha nr minus dab 2 to the n t to the n h to the n over n factorial. And as you can see, e to the alpha dab does not depend on n. So it doesn't enter in our exponential. But this, when I sum this series, I have e to what? Sigma e to the alpha r 2 th over alpha, let me put alpha here, minus d, ab. Very good. So the commutator between a and b is upper bounded by this exponential. Now let me define, let me put h times t. This number, so sigma e to the alpha r 2h over alpha, I call it dlr. As you can see, it has, on a graph, lengths have the dimensions of 1. There are dimensionless. So this has the dimensions of h, which is 1 over t. So it's a speed on a graph. So this is e to the alpha dlr t minus dab, which is the result that we promised. When d AB is greater than this speed that only depends on our initial constants times t, then the commutator between A, T, and B is exponentially small. Beautiful. So in quantum mechanics, there is an emergent light cone with evanescent waves. And you might think that we really need relativity to make it not fuzzy. Because, that, oh, you know, OK, it's emergent, but it's a bit fuzzy. That's the price. Actually, not. It's only fuzzy because we are on a graph. But if a space were continuous, let's see what happens. If space were continuous, then so let's embed the graph in real space, then a length d times a, where a is the lattice spacing, is L. Right? And also, sorry, it's the other way around. L equal dA, no, it's okay. And also, our equilibrium speed is d over t. It will become L over AT, which is 1 over A, L over T, which is our V tilde, the velocity in real space. So all this is equal to e to the alpha over a v tilde t minus l. So you see that in the limit of lattice spacing going to zero, in the continuum limit, it becomes sharp. In that limit, you get limit a going to zero. Every time L is greater than VT, this goes to zero. So you have an emergent sharp light cone in the continuum limit from non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Okay. So this proves the theorem and the result that has enormous number of applications that we will see starting from tomorrow. And I want to come to your question before. Let me rephrase it. You say, do we really need to have all the interactions be upper bounded by a constant? Well, the way Lieb and Robinson proved the theorem, we do. We see it in the mechanism of the theorem that it would not work otherwise. But can we make a different theorem? Yes, we can. In fact, it was proven by there are several. It was proven by I think it is Nachtergaele, no Eisert, sorry, that proved that for some harmonic systems you can that are unbounded, you can have Lieb-Robinson bounds. And it was proven by myself and others that you can make a different theorem, a different Lieb-Robinson theorem, requiring not that phi is bounded, but the commutators between phi I and phi I plus 1 are bounded. So this means that you can have infinite energies, but you can only exchange in an interaction of finite energies. Then you can do the theorem. It's not the same theorem. It changes, but you can do that. But of course, there are quantum mechanical systems with unbounded interactions that do not have an emergent light cone.
The intuition is just that you're bounding the energy, so it cannot excite particles that are fast enough so that they could propagate faster than this light cone because you bounded the energy, right?
The intuition is that since we are on a lattice, how much does it take to propagate an interaction from here to here? Well, if the energy of this step is infinite, then this takes zero time. If you require a finite time for doing one step, one local step, then this means energy is finite. That is the intuition.